Good afternoon. This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, the Subcommittee on Public Safety, opening up a public hearing. I forgot to tell you that it's March 29th, 2017. It's almost the end of the month. I'm opening up the hearing, public hearing on House Bill 5035, Public Defense Service Commission. And I know I've got Ms. Cosine that's coming forth. And who else is coming up with you, Ms. Cosine? Are you it? And Paul Levy, General Counsel for Public Defense Service, Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The agency is continuing with their presentation. If you would like to find that on OLIS, it's with yesterday's meeting, and I believe they're up to slide number 23. They're going to continue with talking about their public service account, which is where approximately 93% of their funds are to pay contractors who provide public defense services at the trial level. But prior to that, they're going to talk about their contract services division within the agency that is charged with managing these complex contracts and ensuring that payments are made and that the contractors are performing. So that's where they're going to begin.
Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the subcommittee, Mr. Bender. We are indeed starting with a description of our contract services today. As a reminder, the contract and financial services portion of our responsibility is 93.2% of our budget. So it really is the majority going out to contractors all around the state. The Public Defense Services Commission enters into contracts for the representation of individuals at the trial court level. We do have some contracts that include appellate representation. Those are case types that are not handled by our appellate division or situations where there's a conflict of interest. They're two-year contracts. We have 107 across the state right now. They start in January of every even year, and so our last cycle started in 2016 and will start up again in 2018. We issue a request for proposals in usually around May of every odd year, so that will be going out soon. And as noted by Mr. Bender yesterday, these contracts, the majority of them, involve a flat rate per case for the attorney services. This slide shows you the different provider types all around the state. We have, you can see those little P's are representative of nonprofit public defender offices. We have 11. We have 33 consortia. A consortium group is private attorneys who have banded together for the purpose of providing public defense services. So these attorneys have their own private law firms or law practices, and they get together with a group, and it's a great model for us because we can contract with one entity, and that entity can actually handle conflicts of interest because they aren't part of the same firm. We then have, and if I didn't mention it, there are 33 consortium around the state. And then we have 14 law firms, and we also use the services of non-contract hourly attorneys. You can see that the only place you'll find that little N is Tillamook County. It's because we have a shortage of contractors in that county. We also use non-contract hourly in instances where a contract provider has a conflict and cannot take the case. This shows the division of the caseload. Approximately 54% of our cases go to consortium providers, 34% to nonprofit public defender offices, 11% to law firms, and only 1% are handled by non-contract hourly providers. This shows you a division of our cases by case type. The vast majority, as you can see, fall into one of three categories, either felony, misdemeanor, or juvenile dependency. Only about 1% of our caseload are termination of parental rights. That's that little TPR symbol you see up there, and 1% Measure 11. ORS 135055 gives people the right to necessary and reasonable fees and expenses for investigation and experts in a case. Our office is responsible for monitoring those requests and either approving them or denying them. In the instance that we deny the request, the presiding judge in the county can take an appeal and can overrule our decision to deny the request. So we receive these requests electronically.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nancy, I'm working on all things public records right now, this session. and this has come up in some of the conversations about attorneys making a public records request with the sheriff, or it could be a variety of needs. Are those expenses also, do they request, because a sheriff might charge $3,000 for the records that the attorney is asking for. How do those requests get handled?
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, Representative Huffman, I think maybe what you're asking about is the discovery cost.
Mm-hmm.
So when a person is being prosecuted, typically the district attorney's office will charge a fee in order to provide the records, whether they're electronic or paper. Different counties have different processes, and our office does pay those costs. So the attorney collects the discovery, and then our office is charged.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So this slide breaks down the expenses, the non-attorney expenses, by case type. And as you can see, it shifts quite dramatically from the caseload. So if you look, for example, at the felonies, it's 37% instead of 30%. If you look at the termination of penal rights, it's 1% instead of 4%. And so we're just looking at those expenses in this slide, the non-attorney expenses. This slide actually combines...
Ms. Cosine, can you provide us with the actual costs and also by county, the probation violation costs?
Yes, we'd be happy to provide that information. So the next slide shows the total cost per case. So this is including the contract attorney rates plus the expenses, just to give you a sense of what we're paying on it for the different case types. This slide shows you what the caseload has been over the years. These are fiscal years, so when you look at this, it's the year ending in July. And as you can see, we had a relatively flat caseload for quite some time. Our mandated caseload has been built on an assumption that there will be 170,000 cases filed per year, and you can see that we've been bumping over year after year. This year, we are experiencing a much higher increase in the caseload. And now we're bumping up into the 175-176 range, which is substantially higher than we've seen in prior years. That's a challenge for us because we have consistently carried forward an overage, you know, an amount above the 170 that causes us to have an uncovered liability at the end of every session. And we've been fortunate in that we've been able to work with the legislature to get that resolved each year, but it does create this rolling forward shortage that we've had year after year. This year, that rolling forward shortage became even more significant because of the caseload overages. The caseload increases that we've been seeing have been primarily on the felony side, and so this chart shows that growth. We presented a similar slide at our budget hearings in 2015 when we started to see the increase, and it has only continued.
Ms. Cosine, again, because I'm trying to find some correlations, can you provide us with those caseload growth of those by counties so that we can begin to have understanding what's happening
mm-hmm.
out there in the universe?
Certainly.
Thank
to.
You.
I wanted to share with you a little bit about the challenges we have at the trial court level. So this slide shows the compensation comparison between nonprofit public defender, non-management employees, and the prosecution function. In our largest counties, as you can see, there is a significant disparity, and it was referenced by our chair yesterday. I wanted to note, it's not on this slide, but attorneys in our office and employees in our office are also compensated at a rate that is lower than the prosecution function. And we'll talk a little bit about that during our policy option package discussion. We withdrew the package that would have addressed that, but I want to note it so that you understand that this is a sort of an across-the-board problem. The challenges at the trial court level, though, really what we're hearing from our providers is that it jeopardizes the stability of the system. The recruitment and retention problems that they are having at the trial court level are really driving high turnover. I think we have a provider coming tomorrow who will describe some of the challenges she has had. It creates substitution of counsel when a lawyer leaves, which creates court continuances. So the system suffers as well as the client and everyone really associated with that criminal case or that juvenile case. We also have then less experienced attorneys handling serious case types. So the problem of turnover and recruitment and retention affects the system as a whole as well as individual clients. Exacerbating this compensation challenge are these increasing student loan debt numbers. We do have providers who've told us that their loan amounts exceed $240,000 and that it's becoming difficult for them to meet their financial obligations. I should note that consortium and private law firm providers have an additional disadvantage because most loan repayment programs require that the person work for a nonprofit entity or the government. And so if they're part of a private law firm that handles public defense cases, they do not qualify for most loan repayment programs. So the third challenge that exacerbates the other two is the caseload. This was referenced also by our chair yesterday. And what we hear is that these high caseloads are contributing to a level of burnout, and they can compromise the quality of representation. These cases are complex cases. Sometimes I've brought the old criminal code, but suffice to say, in 1986, the criminal code was 383 pages. In 2016, it was 903 pages. So almost triple in size in terms of the number of laws on the books. And then you add to that the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court opinions interpreting those laws and how they interact with each other, and it becomes a much more complex field. We also have changing prevailing norms in terms of what entails adequate representation. And so more and more we are hearing from lawyers that it's difficult to cover the caseload at the current case rates. With all of those challenges noted, I would like to turn it over to our general counsel, Paul Levy, who is the anchor of many of our quality assurance efforts.
Good afternoon, Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee. I only have two slides, but there's a lot packed on each of these slides, and Nancy will drive through the slides here. And so what I'm going to do is talk about our main quality assurance safeguards and mechanisms at the agency, and breeze through these pretty quickly. And if you have questions, of course, please ask. As Nancy said, we have over 100 contracts for public defense services. Each of these contracts have quality and performance expectations, both for the lawyers who are doing the work and for the administrators of the contract, so that which asks them to do their own quality assurance work to make sure that the lawyers within their entity, whether it's a public defender office, consortia, or law firm, are providing quality representation. And I'll talk in just a minute more about how we go about monitoring and enforcing these contracts. We also administer qualification standards for lawyers who want to do public defense work. And we have a set of standards that set out the skill and experience and knowledge required to handle particular case types. Lawyers are required to show to us that they meet those minimum qualifications, and we review the information that's submitted and determine what type of case work lawyers should be approved for. We have recently updated both the standards and the process by which we receive this information to get better information and to be able to make better judgments about the qualifications of lawyers. We also publish a document, and by the way, all of this is available on our website, the forms, the standards, these publications. We publish a set of best practices. These are practices for administrators of contractors, describing in detail how they can go about ensuring that their entities provide quality representation. And they're guidelines, they're not mandates, but they're meant to cover all provider types, the law firms, the consortia, and the public defender offices. We're also required to set performance standards for attorneys doing public defense work. And what our commission has done is largely embraced the Oregon State Bar performance standards, which cover the universe of cases that public defense lawyers handle. And they're a good set of standards. They've been updated recently. Again, they are current, they are good. When we were here 2 years ago, we spent quite a bit of time on these standards and a timeline through the life of both criminal and dependency and delinquency cases, showing how those standards come into play at each stage of the case. It was good demonstrative evidence for that what we ask of lawyers, the demands on their time. We're not going to go through that again this time, but you have those materials from last time, including the full set of standards in the budget binders. Turning to how we go about enforcing and monitoring the contracts that we have, one of our most successful programs that we've described to the legislature in the past is what we call our peer review process. And this, we are also told, is fairly unique to Oregon, where we ask a team of volunteer public defense leaders from across the state to devote 3 days, at least 3 days, of intensive evaluation in a county, looking at the quality of representation of a contract provider. And typically, when we're in a county, we'll look at all of the providers we have contracts with in that county. Of course, there's lots of preparation before we get to that site visit, but a team of 5, 6, or sometimes 7 of us, I usually staff and organize these efforts, spend at least 2 full days, 2.5, interviewing all day long participants in the local public safety system, from judges, prosecutors, the defense providers, law enforcement. If we're looking at juvenile representation, we're talking to the Department of Human Services folks, CASAs, and the whole range of people involved to get a sense of the quality of representation being provided by a contractor. And from those visits, we produce a report that recognizes the good work that's being done when we find it. And in fact, we try to draw from these visits best practices that we can recommend to others when we learn of them. But we also identify areas where we see improvements could be made, and we offer assistance in achieving those improvements. We have done 53 of these reviews since 2004. Another process that has gone on simultaneous with these peer reviews are public hearings around the state conducted by our commission, where they look not so much at the quality of each individual provider, but at the structure and the appropriateness of the public defense configuration in jurisdictions. And they will hear from the same type of people that we interview with the peer reviews, judges, prosecutors, and the others involved in the local public safety system, to get a sense of how well public defense services are being provided in a jurisdiction. And as you can see, there have been 28 of these, and there are 27 judicial districts, I think, and so we have pretty much well covered the map and have revisited places as well. Just checking where I am on this slide. We also have a complaint policy and procedure that we administer, and we will receive complaints and concerns from a variety of folks, ranging from clients of public defense providers, or more typically their friends and family, but also from prosecutors, judges, and legislators who receive concerns from their own constituents and want us to address those or help you understand what's going on with a constituent concern. More often than not, these are ongoing cases where we can help facilitate communication between attorney and client and get representation back on track. There are occasions, though, where we have to conduct fairly significant investigations, and they have resulted and do result in a determination that an attorney should no longer be providing public defense services or no longer handling a particular type of public defense case. We also conduct an annual survey. We have completed our ninth annual survey a couple of months ago, statewide survey asking judges, prosecutors, a whole host of people involved in both the criminal and juvenile and civil commitment processes about how well public defense providers are performing in their particular county. We get good information from this, it largely in the form of comments. There's a lot of rate from 1 to 5, how well are people doing, and like questions along those lines that are helpful. But we ask for and solicit comments, and they're very helpful in understanding both what's going on that's good and not so good, and they help us address specific problems in counties. A real key to our contract enforcement is also the work of our 4 non-attorney contract analysts who have the state divided up among themselves. And they work closely with the courts and our providers across the state to make sure that the needs of every court in every county are met every day. Because when somebody comes out the door from the jail into the courtroom, or a parent or a child appears in a dependency case, no matter where it is, when it is in the state, there need to be lawyers there for them, and they need to be able to do the job and do it well. And our contract analysts make sure that those needs are met every day. They learn from judges, presiding judges with whom they have a lot of contact, court administrators, about what's going on in the county, what's working, what's not. They can address lots of concerns that arise, but if they've needed, and it does happen, they will bring concerns about criminal cases to me and concerns about dependency and other juvenile cases to Amy Miller, Deputy General Counsel, who you'll be hearing from in just a moment. Continuing legal education is obviously key to continued good performance of attorneys. We require this, we require a certain number of hours of continuing legal education in the area of practice of lawyers by contract. We gather data on whether those requirements have been met every year, and this is now part of our key performance measure. I don't know, we don't have the slide now on that measure here. Is that later in the show?
No, we talked about that on Monday.
Oh, we talked about that already.
Or yesterday.
Yesterday. Okay. Thank you. Well, so we do monitor this and we enforce it, and that's important. We also participate in the planning and the presentation of these continuing legal education programs, and both in our contract and business services side and in the appellate division side, as you heard yesterday, we're involved in sponsoring and presenting these educational programs. I want to mention two in particular that are really key that we're very involved with. One is the Juvenile Law Training Academy. This is a multidisciplinary program that happens every year. And it's really valuable and very well attended. It is planned and attended by representatives of our office. We primarily instigate the planning and presentation, but along with the Department of Human Services, the Department of Justice, the CASA program, the Marion County District Attorney's Office, the University of Oregon, and others. And then we also present an annual public defense management seminar in conjunction with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This is also well attended. The target audience here are the contract administrators, and what we talk about there are best practices in the management of public defense services. Also best practices and updates in how to run a small business, because most of our public defense providers are small business providers as well in their communities. And finally, I think, we fund two resource attorney programs for areas where there are particular challenges for promoting quality representation, and those are in the death penalty field and in the juvenile law field. So we have specialists that are available for consultation and assistance in those cases. So that's the broad architecture of our quality assurance monitoring and enforcement processes.
With the committee's permission, I would like to now invite up Amy Miller to talk about our parent-child representation program. Is that okay?
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs Winters and Stark, members of the subcommittee. My name is Amy Miller. I'm the Deputy General Counsel at the Office of Public Defense Services. It is a delight to be here today to talk with you about the program I manage, the Parent-Child Representation Program. I must say I'm getting over the same cold that all of us have had, so I apologize. Let me know if I need to speak up. In 2014, the legislature funded the Parent-Child Representation Program in response to testimony and reports over a number of years, which emphasized problems with the quality of legal representation in juvenile dependency cases. This body had heard testimony from our counterparts in Washington State about their parent representation program and how that program improved quality and at the same time delivered cost-effective, positive outcomes through a reduction in the use of foster care and expedited permanency for children. And I'm just going to step through a little bit about the PCRP. Before I do that, I'd just like to mention the tie-in with the governor's task force on legal representation in childhood dependency cases. This task force was created in 2015 as follow-on to Senate Bill 222, and it was charged with studying the dependency system and making recommendations about how to improve that system through legal representation. Justice Brewer chaired that task force. It was staffed by the governor's office, and I'm comprised of all of the high-level decision makers in the system, including Co-Chair Stark as one of the four legislative members. After nearly...
I wanted to point out I was just considered high-level decision maker. Maybe that was the second sentence.
There's an Oxford comma over Co-Chair Stark.
And after nearly a year's worth of, I will note he was highly involved as well. After nearly a year's worth of work, the task force issued and recommended expansion statewide of the PCRP because of its cost effectiveness and its ability to deliver improved outcomes. So House Bill 2345, which is the omnibus bill incorporating the recommendations from that task force, recently passed out of Judiciary. It's on its way to Ways and Means and would be the enabling legislation that sets up the framework for the expansion of the PCRP. And it ties, of course, to our policy option package 100, which you'll hear about later. Thank you. The PCRP is a significant change in the way OPDS contracts for legal services. Attorneys in this program adhere to a workload contract with specific contract obligations that lay the foundation for good work. For example, there are requirements about how the attorneys are expected to spend their time. So we ask that they spend a third of their time in client contact, a third of their time in court and meetings, and a third of their time doing case preparation analysis. And they track and report their hours back to our office. The program also imposes a caseload limit, which allows attorneys the time to provide quality legal representation. As you've heard, high caseloads are problematic in many ways. They prevent attorneys from spending adequate time with clients and attending to work outside of the courtroom. And where caseloads are excessively high, cases are delayed due to the unavailability of attorneys for even regular court appearances. Attorneys in our program also have access to case managers. These are social service professionals who serve as part of the legal team and work on the most complex cases. And the case managers are really a strategic and really highly treasured resource. They're available in about 10-15% of cases and usually hop in to solve kind of a discrete problem. And the strength of case managers as part of the legal team is that they provide confidential assistance to individual clients to help them overcome barriers that led to court involvement. So unlike DHS casework, the case managers focus only on the needs of the particular client, and they're able to, as an agent of the lawyer, maintain a confidential relationship with that client.
Question, can you tell me what was the process that Lynn and Yamhill were selected?
Co-chair, this is dark in winters. The selection... Nancy may be better suited to comment on that because that happened before I was hired into this position while I was still a public defender. But the selection process was made in part due to data about the counties. It was made in part due to the amount of funding that was available and, frankly, proximity of the counties to Salem, right, where the management needed to occur. And I think there was consultation with some of the stakeholders involved, so with DHS, with the Department of Justice, with the Judicial Department about potential locations. Is there anything you want to add?
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, I would be happy to talk more about it and look back at our records. I think Ms. Miller touched on the highlights of what drove the decision-making process. I think the other piece that is in there is willingness of contractors to try something new. So that it was a big culture shift. This was a new model, and so we had to find people who were willing and able to try something different.
Thank you.
So this program is evidence-based. It is closely modeled on a statewide program in Washington that I referenced that has been independently evaluated. It started in 2000 and is consistently shown to deliver better results. And the program has an accountability component, which includes oversight by me as the attorney manager of the program. Thank you. So this slide contains notable observations over the past year in Lynn and Yamhill counties. Since the inception of the PCRP in 2014, we've been tracking these same metrics. Although this slide contains only the past year's worth of data, the changes are pretty consistent since the program began. And I see all of you, some of you looking closely at your screens. I'm going to walk through some of the high-level points in the next couple of slides. So I realize the text is pretty small. Before I do that, I wanted to point out that these are observations only. I can't say that this data is statistically significant or represents causation. We haven't gotten to the point at which we've had that level of study, but at least want to walk through some of the high points with you. So first, reduced use of foster care. In this program, the population of children in foster care is declining much more rapidly than the statewide average. And you can see in 2015-16, the number of children in care statewide actually increased, while it decreased in these counties by an average of 18%. Preservation of
families. Can I ask, because I know there's a lot of other drivers that take place in communities, does both Lynn as well as Yamhill County also have the involvement with these particular cases of CASA as well as relief nurseries?
Senator Winters, Co-Chair Stark, in Lynn and Yamhill County, there is CASA in both counties. I think in Lynn County, I meet regularly with the different system stakeholders. In Lynn County, I think the CASA program is probably more active than it is in Yamhill County. They've had a change of leadership. But it's interesting because in Yamhill County, CASA is often in court asking that case managers play a role in some of the cases that they're involved in. So they work closely together. You asked about relief nurseries, and I know there's a relief nursery in Lynn County, and we've done some coordinating with them. I do not know if there's a relief nursery in Yamhill County.
Is there follow-up? Is there in garnering resources, they're involved actually with some of these cases?
Senator Winters, could you explain?
Never mind. I'll talk to you offline.
I'd be happy to do that. Thank you. I think we can go to the next slide. Thank you. Preservation of families. In the PCRP counties, children are much more likely to be reunified with families. So over the last year, the percentage of children leaving foster care for reunification increased by 12% in the PCRP counties. It increased statewide as well, just at a much more a slower rate.
Senator Steiner here with.
Thank you. I think it may be because I'm underslept, but I'm having trouble with the arithmetic on this one. If the statewide rate of, presumably, the percentage was the same in both groups prior to implementation of PCRP, right? I mean, the groups are this.
Well, one is looking at, Senator Hayward, one is looking at the statewide rate and one is looking at the particular rate in the county.
No, so I understand that, but I'm just, so you're saying that prior to implementation of PCRP, the rate of reunification in Lynn and Yamhill counties was dramatically lower? Because if you have a 12% change and only get to 5% above the 3% change, that's where I have trouble understanding the arithmetic.
Sorry, it's initially it was 61% and it went to 68%, which is a 12% increase.
Oh, it's a 12% relative
correct.
Increase as
sorry.
Opposed to a 12% absolute increase.
Correct.
I
probably could have explained that a little more clearly.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I also wanted to mention time to reunification. Time to reunification in the PCRP counties has decreased while the statewide number has increased. And one question that I've been asked about these reunification numbers is, are these reunifications safe? Because it's not healthy or smart for children to be reunified too quickly and end up back in foster care. So I track in parallel the rate of reentry, which is looking at whether children come back into care over the following 12 months. Both of these counties maintain reunification rates that are lower reentry rates than the statewide average. And this slide looks at the percentage of children achieving permanency within 24 months. Before the PCRP started, Lynn and Yamhill had rates actually lower than the statewide average. The rate has continued to grow in these counties such that it now exceeds the statewide average.
Are you using permanency in to equate the termination process or permanency back into their home?
Senator Winters, Co-Chair Stark, these percentages come from the DHS data. So permanency specifically is looking at whether children are reunified, whether they go into guardianship, or whether they go into adoption. So those are the factors.
So actually the termination and all that, and adoption
it does,
is
yes.
a part of it.
It does.
Okay.
If I may, Madam Chair.
Yes.
So the 71.5%, that means 68% were reunified and 3.5% went into one of these other statuses? Is that because if you have 68% reunification within a certain period of time, then am I not understanding the arithmetic again?
Co-Chair Starks, Winters, and Senator Steiner Hayward, that might be an accurate assumption, although I can't confirm that because this is looking at 24 months and reunifications
right,
at a different
okay.
time period.
Okay.
So I would need to
sorry.
Circle back with
nope,
you to
sorry.
Make that conclusion.
You're right. That's the piece I missed.
No problem.
Oh, good.
I think we're on to the next slide. Sorry. Oh, that's okay.
Then I
yes,
take
Senator.
It back. So I understand, Ms. Miller, that you cannot, that these, well, actually, I'm kind of curious about why these are not statistically significant, because they sure as heck look that way to me. But I understand it's a little tough to know, but do we have any way of estimating the cost savings associated, like what the ROI is when we invest in this kind of representation?
Co-Chair Stark and Winters, Senator Steiner Hayward, I think two more slides and I'll get there.
Cool.
We do have at least a preliminary
yep.
way to
thank
look
you
at
very
that.
Much.
So, and also just want to talk about improved legal representation, which is sort of the foundation. And our data shows that parents and children are really receiving better legal representation. A couple of things I do want to point out about that. Attorneys are consistently present at shelter hearings, which is the first hearing that occurs within the 24 hours after a child being removed from home. Before the PCRP, neither parents nor children had lawyers at this really important hearing where a visitation plan is put into place where parents are really informed of the allegations against them for the first time. In addition, the lawyers in our program are expected to attend DHS and provider meetings where cases are discussed and service plans are developed. And in this type of work, that's a point of emphasis because I've heard some experts talk about parents and children need out-of-court lawyering as much as they need in-court lawyering because this type of work is kind of a combination of law and social work, and so many decisions are made outside of the courtroom. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, lawyers have access to unique resource case managers. So the parent-child representation program has its own key performance measure, which is based on the amount of time attorneys spend with clients. So for 2015-2016, 54% of attorneys report spending approximately one-third of their time with clients. However, I think it's important to note that in our program, because of the use of case managers, client-facing time is actually higher than probably it appears in this slide. The case managers are required to spend 85% of their time in client-facing work. So if you add up the time that the lawyers spend plus the time that the case managers spend, it looks like about an average of 48% of time invested by the defense team is spent with clients or in direct client service. To speak to Senator Steiner Hayward's question, I've been asked to quantify the value of the parent-child representation program, and I will admit this is difficult, partially because the funding for this program is general fund, part of the public safety funding stream, where there are benefits that might be realized in different funding streams. And then, in addition, there's a federal component that plays into foster care. So there are a lot of moving pieces here. I do want to point out first that in the state of Washington, the program has actually shown to have a cost benefit to the state and actually pays for itself. In Oregon, we haven't had that sort of evaluation, but this slide attempts to reconcile both the costs and the benefits. So the additional cost for attorneys is about, what you see here, is about $446,000. I want to be clear, this isn't just additional money for lawyers. In these counties, every lawyer is a local independent practitioner running their own business. And our program covers not only has that compensation component for them, but it covers overhead so that each attorney can maintain an office to meet with clients. It covers staff costs so that each attorney has a person who can be responsive to calls from the court and that meet the needs of clients. In addition, the increase in funding was used to cap caseloads to 80 open cases so that each lawyer maintains a reasonable workload. So in order to do that, three additional lawyers were added to the program, one full-time in Linn County and two half-time in Yamhill County. The case manager cost is a new cost, and like I said before, it's unique to this program. I hear nothing but overwhelmingly positive responses from the court, from system partners about the role of case managers, and they're really credited with keeping some of these really difficult cases on track to reunification. There are five individuals working as case managers, a total of 3.7 FTE. They're also independent contractors. So although the program has additional costs, I think the potential for short and long-term savings is significant. I estimate that
I want to go back because you made a statement with respect to Washington, and that it was very difficult to actually do some analysis, because one, so many funding streams that were involved and what have you. The other probably difficulty is that Washington happens to have the ability to do cost-benefit analysis that we don't have in Oregon. I need to say that for the record because some of us have wanted to have, something similar to that. But also, if I'm doing the math, the attorney contracts and the case manager contracts is somewhere around $736,000 for the 134 individuals that were in foster care, correct?
Co-Chair Stark, Senator Winters, correct. You're doing the math correctly.
Were you able to get the actual cost numbers from DHS?
For the Senator Winters, do you mean for the cost?
For the cost of care for the children.
I received the rate information. I did not receive that total loaded cost. This is the closest number I could find. I will say that this number has been described as including the basic rate costs and staffing costs. It doesn't include court costs, lawyer costs. It doesn't include costs for children who need a higher level of care. So I suspect this is a conservative estimate, but it's the closest estimate that I could find that tries to take into account more than just the monthly rate payment. I do want to mention that There are a number of other efficiencies which result from enhanced legal representation, including holding the agency accountable to the law and to its policies. And although some of these are harder to quantify, I think they merit consideration and discussion as well.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. Madam Chair, you know all too well, and I'm sure other people in this committee do, that this point about the collateral consequences of foster care is really significant. We know that being separate, when children are separated from their families of origin, that it increases their adverse childhood experiences, which in turn leads to decreased high school graduation rates and long-term health consequences. And the longer they're apart from their families, the worse that is. I mean, assuming that they can go back safely and be in an appropriate home. But I feel really strongly that we have to be thinking about this, because although it's hard to see the long-term savings.
How much can we get out of your budget?
I'm working on that right now. I just sent an email to my co-chair saying we need to talk to the two of you about this, because I do think we need to be thinking. I mean, it's a tangent, but honestly, if you think about how many different agencies affect the lives of very young children in this state and how complicated it is to figure out the funding streams, this is a great example of that, and this is just two little programs.
But
I think we need to talk more about this as a committee and as, you know, between the chairs.
I think there's two things that jump out, and that's, the early engagement before shelter hearings.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things that I think that we've all have been grappling with is what happens at the front end and how decisions that are being made that have a lifelong effect on children. So I think we're all, and I see some heads nodding around here about that particular piece. So, yes. Thank you. Yes, Representative Huffman.
You guys might be interested to know I submitted a concept last night that would, it's a House concurrent resolution that would encourage all agencies to use trauma-informed care sanctuary model and ACEs.
Good.
And to elevate those and create better knowledge around them and the use.
That's really good to know, Representative. That's cool. Talk to you a little bit more about that. Okay.
Go ahead, Ms. Miller. We get off track sometime.
Thank you for the winters. So if the PCRP were to be expanded in some capacity, I'm back one slide here.
Oh, do
no, you're okay. This is just a list of possible counties for consideration, taking into what I try to do is do an objective look based on some data at need, readiness, and impact of potential counties. And none of this is written in stone, but what the point I'd like to make here is that the PCRP is scalable and can be easily replicated. So, you know, when thinking about if it were possible to expand this program, it doesn't need to be an all or nothing thing. And that's actually reflected in our policy option package request, looking at about
can
a part
I
of the
ask
state.
Can I ask, I'm going to ask budget questions now. You know, if and I the dollars of the savings, how do we capture those dollars for use in other places in the budget? You know, we get this that you know, proposals that are capturing savings, and so my first thing, if we're saving those dollars, where do we find those savings that we can reuse those dollars?
In her committee.
Well,
I'm not going to. You don't need to answer. I'm not going to put you on the spot to answer that.
My co-chair and I are already
But it's something I'd like for others to begin thinking about as they come before us to have in their POPs and their proposals that we're saving dollars. You know, particularly in this environment that where we're actually looking for dollar savings. So I just need to put out there when I read the thing and say, where do I get them? So,
well,
continue, Ms. Miller.
Okay, I was going to say something about that. That's all right.
No. I'm not going to put you on the spot.
Okay.
No, actually, we
thank you, Senator Winters. I think so as I said, the program can be rolled out slowly or quickly, and you know, I think it's important to be planful if that were something to be considered. One of the things I was also asked to do is look at what a timeline could be, and I am a prior engineer, and so I have a very detailed plan back at my desk. I'm in order to summarize it for you here. It's much smaller, but you know, I think this timeline anticipates a rollout for up to 3 medium-sized counties, or maybe 2 small ones and a large one, if that was how it, the selection went. As you know, the Office of Public Defense Services, particularly on the contracting side, has a really lean staff, so it's really important for us to be realistic and planful about our capacity. There's a lot of foundational work to be done, as this program really requires making local system change, and I think that's one of the key learnings I have as a manager of the program, that it does take some time to get things going because things have to be changed at the local level.
Have you had contact with those counties to see if there's some interest in those counties?
Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, yes, I have. I've had conversations with the counties, have talked to the attorneys in the counties, have talked to others in the counties as well. And we meet regularly with sort of a system stakeholder group, including the Department of Justice, the Judicial Department, CASA, Department of Human Services, and so we've also been talking about appropriate counties in that group as well. So I anticipate that the groundwork could be laid such that a program could start in January of 2018 with the case manager component to begin rollout in March of 2018. And I think that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer any more questions or talk later.
Thank you. Ms. Kozine.
All right. So we have a few last things to cover before our hearing today ends. Budget drivers. We have many budget drivers, also very difficult to predict and capture, but I'll run through our list of budget drivers as we have identified them. So legislative and voter-initiated changes to criminal and juvenile laws that create new offenses, enhance penalties, or alter procedures. There are several of those types of bills pending before this body now. And I would also add that there are a few bills that would also add to our responsibilities. So there's a bill that would require the Public Defense Services Commission to provide lawyers to people mm-hmm. in probate guardianship cases. There is a new bill that just dropped that would require the PDSC lawyers to provide enhanced immigration consultation. So we're tracking all of these bills and providing information to Legislative Fiscal Office in terms of what the potential fiscal impact mm-hmm. could be of proposed legislation. Another factor is case law changes in state and federal appellate courts. When the Padilla case issued, for example, that's the case that said that defense providers must provide information about potential immigration consequences. So when things like that happen, it creates an additional burden for defense lawyers, and they end up requesting additional rates. We also have seen changes when there are changes in law enforcement or district attorney policies, practices, and staffing levels. Changes in court procedures or schedules. Specialty courts can require lots of time from a defense attorney. They can also create some efficiencies at times. Oregon's crime rate can have an effect, as well as the availability of jail space, and of course, recidivism rates. Also, changing prevailing norms for adequate representation, demographic trends, especially increases in the population or the at-risk population, the condition of Oregon's economy and rates of unemployment and poverty, because more people can become qualified for our services, rates of removal of children from their homes, and access to social services such as drug treatment and family support services that can reduce the criminal behavior or the need for court intervention. So, in terms of our agency request budget, this is a breakdown of our 2015-17 legislatively approved budget and then the current service level. As I mentioned earlier, the current service level is based upon a projection of a lower caseload than we are experiencing right now. We had already seen an increase coming, and we projected 172,500 cases for the upcoming year. But as I said, we are experiencing something even higher right now. We did, on the agency request budget, do a downward adjustment from our original request. You'll notice that the commission originally had adopted 6 policy option packages. They ended up withdrawing 2. So this is, this amount is an adjusted amount to reflect that reduction. This is the current service level, all components that would be required to maintain our existing services. And then this slide shows our policy option packages. So the 2 that are shaded are the packages that the commission voted to withdraw in light of the current budget situation. I wanted to note again that the employee compensation package 103 was withdrawn by the commission because we were able to self-fund to get our employees to within 10% of other state agencies. But I do want to note that there are other sacrifices that had to be made, and there are other things that our office had to give up. So one of those is securing additional space. We have 12 lawyers who are sharing offices, and as appellate lawyers, that can be a very difficult environment to focus in. But we made the decision for recruitment and retention purposes to proceed with a compensation plan change in the hopes that people would stay in our office despite the less than perfect work environment. It still is a very hopefully good place to work. So we've withdrawn that package, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of context. We felt that in comparison to the disparities at the trial level, it was worth pursuing that package instead of the employee compensation package at OPDS. Then moving back to the top, policy option package 100 is expansion of the parent-child representation program, as we've just discussed. And then, so I'll cover that one. This expansion.
Yes, of Co-Chair Stark.
All right, thank you, Co-Chair Winters. Will you remind us real quick, in this POP for the PCRP is just for the first phase, right?
Correct.
So when all is said and done, full implementation, what's the cost, the expected cost to roll out to the entire state?
Right. So if we had the package was originally structured as Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, members of the subcommittee, the package was originally structured as a statewide rollout, and it was closer to $34 million. I think that it's safe to assume that that will, if we choose a staged approach, the number will change because, each biennium cost will increase to some degree. The commission chose to reduce that package to the 10.8 to cover approximately a third of the caseload across the state in light of the budget environment. So, and that I should also mention while I'm on this, back on this slide, that the commission also reduced policy option package 104. We had had an additional position in that package that we removed. So in terms of how policy option package 100 is currently structured, this would provide funding to cover one-third of the statewide caseload, and Ms. Miller went through the various county options that we see as being potentially the most viable for this session. We also then have included in that cost the staffing for the program. So right now, Ms. Miller acts as the attorney manager for the 3 existing counties. In order to add more counties, we need another attorney manager to come on board. Policy option package 101 is the package that would allow our contract providers to have rates so that they could try to reach parity with prosecutors in their counties. So the slide that showed you the disparities around the state, it varies from county to county. This is the package that would help remedy that and help our providers attract and retain quality attorneys in public defense organizations throughout the state. This amount, I wanted to mention there's House Bill 2561. This is actually not a PDSC bill, but it was a bill that was dropped this session that would also affect contractor parity. And so I wanted to highlight it. It was heard in Judiciary Committee a couple weeks ago, and there is some interesting testimony that was provided during that hearing that you might also be interested in. It was structured slightly differently than this policy option package, and so the costs of the two are slightly different. And this number is a statewide number. Jumping then to Policy Option Package 104, this is the policy option package to help us continue development of our quality assurance program at OPDS. One of the components would be a data analyst. Ms. Miller mentioned that we don't have anyone in-house right now who is qualified to do the data analysis on the PCRP. We would, if we had the data analyst position, dedicate that person half-time to analyzing PCRP data, which Ms. Miller, thanks to her engineering background, is now able to do. But we would like to have a data analyst in-house to help us with that work. And then we would also have that person spend half their time comparing the data from PCRP counties to non-PCRP counties and help us develop metrics around quality assurance data inquiries around the state. This also includes a permanent position of Deputy General Counsel that would specialize in developing different programs on the criminal side that would be analogous to the parent-child representation program. So this is a package that would help us continue to develop our ability to monitor and ensure quality representation across the state. Policy Option Package 105 is the package that would address that recurring shortfall that we've seen in our budget biennium after biennium. So we had originally structured this as a $3.5 million package because that was the amount we saw that we were falling short each biennium. As I mentioned, this biennium has had a spike in caseload that's created a much larger deficit, and we have worked closely with the legislature to close that gap. You wanted to know a little bit about reduction options. For the Public Defense Services Commission, reduction options are difficult because of the existing disparities and challenges. So a reduction at the appellate level would really create a delay in our ability to file the opening brief. You recall from yesterday, the agency worked hard to get that median date to filing the opening brief down to what is now the 209 days, the best really in the agency's history. And if we were to reduce staffing, that number would, you would see that number creep back up again. At the trial level, the agency would not be able to provide representation for the final month and, or excuse me, 1.5 months of the biennium. And then in terms of operations of the agency, it would slow down our ability to pay the bills that come in, contract payments, NRE requests. The non-routine expense requests are those requests for investigators and experts that lawyers from the trial court submit to our office. We try to get those turned around as quickly as possible because we know that there are cases hanging in the balance as we consider the request. So we like to try and get those back to providers within 2 business days. A 10% reduction would exacerbate the delays. At the trial level, it would be the final 3 months of the biennium. And then there would be further delays in the appellate and operations functions. And, of course, at the 15% level, it would be exacerbated. So it would be the final 4.5 months of the biennium and further delays in appellate and operations processing. Of course, as noted by the Chief Justice, our cases, public defense cases, comprise about 85% of the court's felony caseload and 70% of the court's misdemeanor caseload. As we saw in 2003, reductions to the PDSC budget have a ripple effect on the system statewide. This is the last slide I have for you today, and it is just a reminder about the importance of quality representation. I know you've already heard quite a bit, but yesterday you heard Mr. Lannett talk about the protection of people's individual rights, their constitutional rights, and the fact that it is an essential part of creating a balanced public safety system. Today you heard from Amy Miller about family protections and the incredible benefits that we really can see with enhanced representation in dependency and termination of parental rights cases. I think tomorrow you will have written testimony provided that will show you that In Yamhill County, the number of termination of parental rights cases filed in the jurisdiction have declined dramatically since the launch of the PCRP program. And when you look back at that slide that shows you the cost of TPRs, you can see that that's actually quite a savings right there in our own budget, potentially. Of course, we've switched the model there, so we no longer pay per case. But in other counties, if we can drive down the number of TPR proceedings that are filed, that is a savings. We also talked a little bit about due process rights, and I want to bring that up specifically in the civil commitment process, where people are losing their liberty as a result of concerns about their ability to care for themselves, or potentially their risk to others. The integrity of Oregon's juvenile and criminal justice systems really do rely upon a strong and adequately funded defense function. So tomorrow you'll hear from individual providers and other stakeholders in the system, and I hope you'll find that to be an interesting day, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
I have one question, in fact several, because I want to go back to the program that Ms. Miller has, mm-hmm. and whether or not you're doing a tracking system beyond enough to talk about sustainability and families still being united. I say that because looking at the termination of parental rights, and in full disclosure, I did the research and demonstration that gave us that program back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. So, And I know that you use that to say that, you know, we've shortened that time, and that's a positive. But also, I think we want to be sure that the tracking model is in place to determine what's happening with families and what is happening with children, and whether or not, you know, that stability is holding.
Mm-hmm.
So how long is the tracking system in place, and for what length of time?
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the subcommittee, mm-hmm. I'm going to invite Amy Miller back up to talk about that. I know she is. I think what you're really getting at is the whether or not they're returning to the system. And so,
and how long are we going to track that?
Mm.
Well,
excuse me. Co-Chair Stark and Winters, members of the subcommittee. So your question is about termination of parental rights cases and whether or not that once these children presumably end up in an adoptive placement, whether they end up back in the system.
You have two pieces. One is the going forward into adoptive cases. Mm-hmm. Then there are some cases that do not get there, but families are reunited and you no longer have to go through with the termination.
Co-Chair Stark and Winters, that some of that data is publicly available through the DHS website. So when I pulled together the sort of the metrics that, so I have kind of 15 solid metrics that I track this program against, and those metrics actually were developed by the American Bar Association Center on Children and the Law in terms of kind of metrics for quality legal representation in these types of programs. So those are the ones I'm constantly measuring against. The question that you're asking is not one of the ones I'm constantly measuring against. It is available. And so let me grab it for you.
Because I would think that since it's a new program, it's new, that we would want to be able to have those outcomes and that particular information. And I recognize, and I don't know whether Washington does it or not, but I recognize we're talking longitudinal data rather than, you know, something that's going to happen within a year.
Mm-hmm. And that Co-Chair Stark and Winters, and that may be the reason that it's not something that's kind of that it's in that bevy of those 15 data points and sub data points that I pay attention to, but it is available. So I'd love to talk with you more about it, and I appreciate the suggestion because it's probably something we should be incorporating as the program grows, for sure.
Okay. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Steiner.
I've been sitting here wrestling in my head and thinking about money. And thinking about other kinds of outcomes. And Ms. Miller, I got to say, I'm sitting here thinking I wish I could clone you for a bunch of other programs. You really are doing an amazing job with this program, and this kind of evidence is super important for decision making. But how do we think about measuring the kinds, I mean, you haven't had this program in place long enough to know whether, for example, these children are more likely to graduate from high school than kids who aren't there. I'm hoping we can figure out a way to track this long enough to demonstrate that. How many of them end up in OIA's custody or involved somehow in the juvenile justice system? The questions, the ramifications of the potential for this program are really enormous in terms of the long-term well-being of Oregon's children. And I'm trying to think about how do we, whether it's Representative Huffman's trauma-informed practices, which I think are super important and I really support, or whether it's the wrestling between Co-Chair Stark and Winters and Co-Chair Rayfield and myself on the child welfare side of this budget, how do we think about measuring the interaction and how much of the child welfare money is actually federal money, and therefore that's a different issue. I'm just trying to think about how do we think about if we could invest in the best of all possible worlds, the $11 million in Policy Option Package 100 to get a third of these kids represented, what does that do to other numbers in our budget in this biennium and in the next biennium and the biennium after that, which we have to be thinking about?
Mm-hmm. And Co-Chair Stark and Winters, Senator Steiner Hayward, I think those are that's the magic question. And the state of Washington, I think, probably offers the best guidance because their program has been around the longest. And that doesn't answer specifically your question, but I think it's important to do some pre and post studies as well, to do some longitudinal studies, yeah, about some of these cases. And that is on my radar and something I want to move forward and do. It's too early to we can certainly speculate. And you pointed to collateral consequences of foster care, and it's certainly something that you can speculate to. And I have, anecdotal bits of information here and there, but I think it's something that I need to be paying attention to, and we all do, in terms of all of these programs.
Okay,
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, with that, I know that tomorrow is public testimony. So if there's no further questions, comments, we are adjourned. Thank you, Ms. Kozine, Ms. Miller.
Nancy, can I talk to you?
You just passed out.
Nancy, can I talk to you?